You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
We're Heathen and Heretic Apparel. Our clothing is inspired by the cultures we grew up in. Metal, punk, a little bit of goth, and all things dark. We offer men's, women's, and unisex t-shirts, tank tops, hats, and accessories. And right now, Heathen and Heretic is offering 20% off our entire store to all podcast listeners. Just use the promo code TOUR20 at checkout. That's T-O-U-R-20. Visit our online store at heathenandheretic.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Heathen and Heretic Apparel. Check us out.
Episode number 63 of That One Time on Tour is brought to you by the band The Guts. The Guts, spelled G-U-T-Z, are a three-piece punk rock band formed in 2012 in Santa Cruz, California. The Guts create an eclectic mix of multifaceted song arrangements, keeping your fist pumping track by track. New Noise magazine calls their brand of melodic heartfelt punk downright addictive. For more information on The Guts and dates for their upcoming tour through the Pacific Northwest, you can check out thegutsband.com and also on Instagram at thegutspunkrock. Now here it is, their new single, Bro Culture.
Let's go! Hey, this is Chris from Propaganda, and you're listening to That One Time on Tour.
Run for the gold, cause it's going on and on. We'll be driving through the darkest night until the break of dawn. We'll be heading for the cities, another show for us to play. To get back in the bank tomorrow, we'll do it. We'll do it all again.
Hey, everybody out there in podcast land, what is going on? As always, this is Chris Swinney. I'm your host for That One Time on Tour, back with another killer episode. If you don't know, this is my podcast where I get to sit down with someone in or around the music industry and have an amazing conversation, and this week is no different. Before I tell you who's on the episode this week, I would like to give everybody a huge shout out for checking out last week's episode with Jonathan and Eric from the now defunct band Brazil, but they are getting back together to have a reunion show in Indianapolis at the Hi-Fi on August 30th. Make sure to get your tickets. Go to hifiindy.com for more information. Thanks for checking that episode out. We charted and it was awesome. And I'd like to thank Jonathan and Eric for coming on the show a second time. So this week on the show, this is a big one for me. It's kind of a bucket list thing. There are a few bands that I kind of put up there at the top, and this guy is in a band that I put up at the top. I'm talking, of course, about Mr. Chris Hanna from the band Propagandi. We go back and forth at the beginning, a little joke, Propagandi. You guys will have to wait to hear that. It's pretty funny. But yeah, this one was crazy. I got to talk to basically one of my favorite songwriters of all time, and we just shot the shit about gear and the history of the band, and I told him about the time I met him, and I didn't really know it was him because I never saw a picture of him. We were on tour in Winnipeg, and he actually remembered. He had a vague memory of meeting me as well. So before we get to my conversation with Chris, and man, it's a good one. I had such a great time talking with him. We need to pay some bills, you know? That's what we do every week. We have sponsors. We have some amazing sponsors. You heard at the beginning of the episode, we had the band The Guts, G-U-T-Z. This is their second time sponsoring an episode, so I want to give a shout out to The Guts. Check them out, and they're amazing. All the info will be in the show notes, and you can go back and listen if you need to get any of the info about The Guts. But check them out. Love those guys. They're great. We also have a new sponsor, Heathen and Heretic Apparel. You heard their little spot at the beginning of the episode. They have some amazing clothes, and like they said, it's inspired by punk and goth and metal and everything dark. So check out Heathen and Heretic. They're on all the social medias, and they'll be in the show notes as well. One of my favorite sponsors of all time, we have Merge 4 still on the show. They make socks. You know about Merge 4. They've got socks with, you know, skaters and bands and artists, and they're just amazing. We're going to do a Patreon-only contest for some Merge 4 apparel. So if you want to be eligible for that and you want to help the show out, go on over to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. Get involved at the $5 level, and you will be eligible to win some really cool free stuff from Merge 4, as well as some of our other sponsors as well. So last but not least, I have Permanence Tattoo Gallery over in Anderson, Indiana. My friend Jacob Harrison is the owner and one of the amazing tattoo artists at that shop. And you guys need to go over there. It's on Meridian Street in downtown Anderson, Indiana. You can check them out on Facebook, Instagram, everywhere at Permanence Tattoo Gallery, and they will hook you up with some tight ink, bro. Okay, so I'm going to try to keep this thing short. I do have a TOTOT radio segment this week. No top five list. I asked Chris a top five list, actually. So, yeah, so go ahead and roll the theme music. It's time for TOTOT radio. On this edition of TOTOT Radio, I am highlighting an awesome band by the name of Non-Starter. They are the band of actually past guest Sean Colon. He directed the documentary on Fat Records. A Fat Wreck is what it's called. And he has an awesome band called Nonstarter. They have a new EP coming out. Actually, I think it's already out on Dang Records. It's called Seasoned Stuntman. It's really cool, kind of skate punky. It's got some like metallic sounding stuff in it. I love it, man. Sean sent me some of the stuff and it's amazing. So you guys need to check out Nonstarter on Dang Records. They have a band camp. Go ahead and just Google Nonstarter band and all the information will also be in the show notes. But we're going to check out their new single off of Seasoned Stuntman. It's the title track. So here it is, Seasoned Stuntman by Nonstarter. So there it was, man. Nonstarter with Seasoned Stuntman. Love that band. Sean, thank you so much for sending me the EP. I love it. You guys go out there and check out Nonstarter on Dang Records with their new EP, Seasoned Stuntman. Okay, so that is the intro, guys. Thank you so much for listening to everything. You know, I try to add content. I know a lot of you came to hear Chris from Propagandhi, and that's what we're going to do right now. But, you know, I like to spice it up and have different things going on the show with the top five lists and with the TOTOT radio segments. And, you know, that's how it goes. So we're going to get into my conversation. Make sure you're following us on all of the social media platforms. It's at TOTOT Podcast. If your band or company wants to sponsor an episode or two, hit me up, TOTOTPodcast@gmail.com. Leave me a voicemail. It might get played on the show. You can talk about anything you want, make suggestions for guests, anything your heart desires. You can call the TOTOT hotline. It is 1-765-372-8255. 8818. That is it. We're going to get into my conversation. This is one of my favorite episodes ever, and it was so much fun. So without further ado, here it is, my conversation with Mr. Chris Hanna from the almighty Propagandhi. Here we go. And I'm on the line with Mr. Chris Hanna from Propagandhi. How are you doing today, Chris?
Hi, it's Propagandhi.
Yeah, I know. We were just talking in Canada. See, that's the thing. My whole life, I've been listening to you guys since the first record, and I've been a huge fan. And I've always said Propagandhi because in my mind, it was like propaganda mixed with Gandhi. But then I've heard you and other Canadians say Propagandhi. So I was worried I would say it wrong.
Yeah, well, I think Americans have said it for so long that it's kind of spread across the border. Even Canadians and Europeans say it now. So,
yeah, my one of my buddies, Shane Told from Silverstein, he's got a podcast and he's talked about you guys quite a bit. And I've always heard him say Propagandhi. So in my mind, I was like, well, maybe it's not a Canadian thing since he's from Ontario, you know?
Yeah. I think it's definitely now officially Propagandhi.
Okay. So I'd like to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you so much for being on the show. Like I said, I'm a huge fan. I've been listening forever. I'm a guitarist, and I've got to say a lot of your riffs really influenced me as far as how I write things.
Oh, awesome. Thanks.
And I mean, we talk about a lot of stuff on this podcast, and we're going to do a deep dive here in a second. But as far as, you know, writing your songs and coming up with the music, I mean, what is your background as far as theory? Are you just like a shredder guy that just, you know, has all the feeling, or do you know a lot of the theory behind it?
No theory. I have no idea about musical theory. By this point, I know a few of the chords down by the nut.
Yeah.
I know what they're called, but I don't understand why scales work in certain keys and other keys. Like, I really don't. Sulin, when she joined the band like in the past 2 years, she's a guitar teacher, and she came in and tried to teach me some theory, and it lasted about 15 minutes. And it's just like fucking physics to me. So
what's your approach when you sit down? Do you just jam until you get a riff that you enjoy, or is there any kind of, you know, like, you know, chaos, like a way that you do it, you know?
No, we just kind of, I think both Todd and I, Todd's the other main songwriter in the band, I think we just sit around with our guitars until we find something that kind of reminds us of the music that really moved us when we were younger. And then we start to develop that and see if we can connect it to other musical pieces, and then see if it inspires any kind of vocals or a lyric direction. Yeah, it's all very, very, it's very random. And I really wish there was a formula, because then we could just do that and have records out every year, but there's not.
And you guys tend to tune in E flat, correct?
Oh fuck. We're such a disaster tuning wise. We have E flat is sort of the standard for the past three records. It used to be E, but we also have drop D. We also have a B tuned up. We also have drop C sharp. Like, it's just a big mess live. Like, there's capos flying all over the place. Yeah.
So yeah, because I think I was in preparation for this, I watched a couple interviews, and I saw a gear rundown where you were talking to this guy in Nashville about your gear, and you were talking about the capos, but you also only tour with like one or two guitars. So that must be kind of a nightmare. Do you tune down to the lowest and then use the capos to do all the other tunings?
No, now we have, both Sulin and I take two guitars. One is E flat standard. The other one is going to be for the drop Ds and for the C sharps.
Okay.
And we try to just plan the sets so that all the drop D songs happen in one section, all C sharps happen in one section, and the rest of the flats happen elsewhere, which is kind of like, it kind of narrows how much fun you can have making your set.
Yeah.
But it, I mean, such a drag for the crowd to see people just standing up there, you know, tuning their fucking guitars. So
yeah. And you guys are using the Fractal system on tour, correct?
Yeah. Sulin and I both use the FX8, which is like, not amp modeling. It's just it's an effects unit. So we use real amps, and we just use that because it's so easy to fly in with this thing.
Yeah,
you know, instead of bringing a giant pedal board and getting charged by the airlines for another giant fucking bag.
There's probably less like chances of something going wrong as well, since it's all like inclusive in the system, correct?
Kind of. That's the rationale, is that, you know, on a pedal board, especially one, if me or Sue Lin make it, it's just a fucking bunch of spaghetti, you know, it's like cables everywhere and something goes wrong and suddenly you have to troubleshoot,
yeah,
you know, 20 cables in front of this crowd of people. Whereas the fractal, if it fails, well, you know, it's, you know what it is. It's the whole thing's done. So figure something else out. So, yeah, that's why we do it.
That's cool, man. Well, I wanted to tell you a story really quickly because, I met you in person one time, and it's kind of a funny story I've talked about on the podcast before. You probably don't remember anything about this, but I used to tour with a band from Canada called The Reason. And, we were playing, you know, you kind of maybe know those guys a little bit.
Was The Reason on Small Man Records at one point?
Yeah, this is actually the first, right after they signed a Small Man and their record on Small Man came out, we were on tour and we were playing in Winnipeg. I can't remember the name of the bar, but we were playing a show with this kind of punk band called the Black Halos.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd been a fan of you guys for so long, like literally one of my favorite bands. I'm not trying to fanboy out or anything, but you guys never really had pictures of yourself in the CDs. And, you know, I guess I'm a stupid American. I never really knew what you guys looked like. So I'm sitting at the bar after we played, and I meet this very nice fellow with a baseball cap on and start talking about music. And I was drinking a Prairie Fire because the guy I was hanging out with told me it's a good drink. And the thing that was funny was spill the beans. It was you. You said, well, what are some of your favorite bands? And I was going through the list of stuff, and I mentioned, well, we're in Winnipeg. I've got to talk about Propagandhi. And you kind of smiled and you looked at me and you said, yeah, I sing in that band. And I felt like such an asshole because I had no idea. And we'd already been talking for like an hour and a half at that point.
Well, that's okay. We probably had so many Prairie Fires. We didn't know what we were talking about anyhow.
No, and I've told that story so many times. It's like, man, you know, one of my favorite bands that I put up there with, you know, like, you know, Metallica got me into playing music. And then, you know, when I got into punk rock, you guys were a really big part of that. And I'm sitting there talking to you forever. And then all of a sudden, oh, I'm talking to the singer and guitarist of one of my favorite bands. It was kind of mind blowing, you know.
Was it a guy named Quentin who was feeding you the Prairie Fires?
That sounds super familiar. Like I'm saying, man, this was like early 2000s.
I feel like I almost have like a vague memory of that situation you're describing. It sounds like it might have happened at the alternative cabaret.
I think that's where it was. Yeah, yeah. And the thing was, like, we opened the show, the Black Halos played, there wasn't a big turnout at all. And then we all just kind of hung out at the bar, and it was almost like after hours.
Yeah.
And I was sitting at the bar just bored out of my mind, and you were sitting there, and we just struck up a conversation. And that's why I didn't really know if you would remember any of it, because it's been so long ago. But to me, it stuck with me for quite a while.
Oh, cool, man. That was, I do kind of remember that. I definitely remember hanging out after hours with Quentin at that place.
And I remember there being the guy that was making it was a friend of yours. So I think that's probably, it's cool that you have a vague memory. That makes me feel pretty cool. Okay. Well, what I want to do is on this show, we always talk about kind of the beginnings of things. And I mean, I know the whole band's history. So I just want to know, with you, were you learning guitar at a young age? Like, what bands were you into? What made you decide that music was kind of an avenue you wanted to go down?
Venom.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
I was mildly into and interested in Priest and stuff like that. And then Maiden, that was my first show, was Maiden and Twisted Sister. But, when I heard Venom, it must've been 82. And I just thought, holy shit, there's either something wrong with this record or this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. And I think I could probably do this.
Yeah.
So I asked if I could have a guitar for Christmas that year, and I couldn't believe it. My mom didn't just get me one. She got me a fucking Flying V.
That's awesome.
And and I just sat there listening to Venom and Exodus and Bathory and trying to play along. And learning no theory, but having a good time. That's how it started. Yeah.
So was Propaganda, I talk to people on this show a lot, and you'd be surprised the band that kind of, you know, becomes their career as their first band. Now, were there a lot of bands before Propaganda for you?
No, that was, I think, pretty much it. Like, me and Jord had decided to do this around, we were probably 15 or 16. And, I mean, the first band I played live with was a different band called Crawl, but that was just, you know, something that was happening on the side.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always, we did lots of kind of side projects here in Winnipeg too, but it was always Propaganda from the beginning. There was a band from Winnipeg called Corpus Vile, and they put out a record on Fringe Records back in the day. They were fucking awesome. And I was in them for one day.
Was there a really good scene back then around, like, because you guys on the internet, of course, it says you guys formed in Portage La Prairie, but you guys ended up in Winnipeg later on. What was the scene like back then? Was there a good, like, thriving local scene up there?
Not in Portage La Prairie, but we had a very strange and excellent record store there called Busy Fingers, which was also it was a sewing shop. And they had sewing shop and they had speed metal records.
Wow.
So, you know, that's kind of how we got into it. And then in Winnipeg, it was an awesome scene. I thought it was amazing. Like, we kind of got into it just at the end of the Personality Crisis Stretch Marks era.
Okay.
Which was a cool era, but it wasn't really my thing. The time I got into it was more when Corpus Vile, Global Genocide, Artificial Life, DAC, like lots of, kind of semi crossover, you know, like metallic crossover bands. That was really my thing. And it was kind of a magical time because there was a DIY venue called The Cauldron, you know, upstairs in this old warehouse. And it was really exciting time because there was no formalized way of putting on a show. There was no security. There's no lineups, you know, it was just fucking chaos, and it was a good time.
has the metal, since, you know, you said you got into Venom and all those bands, has that always been something that's been attractive to you?
Metal bands?
Yeah, I mean, just like because you guys, you know, when you put out the first record, it was sort of more along the lines of punk rock and whatnot, but there's always been those metal tinges and, like, the aggressiveness in your music and the angular guitar playing. So, like, at the beginning, when you got into those bands, was it easier for you to maybe go the punk route just because it takes a while to get good enough on guitar to play metal?
Yeah, exactly. You know, cause I had also, just a few years prior to the How to Clean Everything, record, I had heard that first Bad Religion record, Suffer. And I thought, holy shit, this is like, it's like the Ramones, but with Motorhead, And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And again, this is something I think my playing is more in the ballpark of this than it is of Creator, which I was, you know, trying to play Creator riffs all the time.
That's hard, man.
So, I think that's how we kind of ended up in that sort of SoCal Fat Records scene, you know?
Was there a distinguishing line drawn in the sand with bands in the Winnipeg area, like punk bands, metal bands, or did everybody just play together like one big like scene?
Everybody played together when we started. There was no difference. Like, our first show was with Immortal Possession, which was a death metal band, and like a street punk band called, what the fuck were they called? I can't remember. You know, it was just everybody just played with everybody.
Were there a lot of bands that, like, would hit, you know, Canada on their tours, like bigger bands? Were they stopping in Winnipeg?
But in the 80s, yeah. Like, there was all the big punk bands, Government Issue, Corrosion of Conformity, DRI, Circle Jerks, everybody came to Winnipeg. But then when the 90s hit, maybe not so much. Like, Winnipeg's like you only come here if you have to.
I'll just say that when I was there that time I met you, man, it was the summertime. The mosquitoes were so bad. It was horrible.
Well, it's kind of, there have been no mosquitoes here in like 3 summers now, and I'm kind of worried about it.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like the canary in the coal mine, but I mean, worse than mosquitoes in Winnipeg is just that there's, for bands,
there's no money here. Like it's a pretty, it's an economically depressed city relative to places like Calgary or Edmonton, you know, which are oil rich. And lots of bands have had some, negative experiences, you know, here, not in terms of turnout or whatever, but getting their vans robbed or whatever. So, yeah, like people seem to avoid Winnipeg, especially these days. Like they go to Alberta.
When you guys were playing back then, you got the band started, you know, I, in some of my research, I saw that, you know, you guys opened up for Fugazi. Of course you opened up for NOFX when all that stuff like took place, but were you kind of the go-to band when bigger bands would come through to open, or like, how did you get on those early shows?
We weren't the go-to band. No, it was kind of spread out evenly. It just so happened we had like, these legendary brothers, the Riel brothers, used to put on some of the shows, and they were friends of ours. So if they had a show coming up, they would ask us, and we knew like kind of the mid-level punk rock promoters. They were usually our friends, and they would just kind of share the wealth, let different bands open different shows. We weren't the go-to by any stretch of the imagination though.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers, think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.
Were you guys doing any like small tours back then, or was it all pretty localized?
It was very local until I think 1991 or 92. Was it 92? Must have been 92. I think we went on this short, hapless disaster of an American tour.
Do you have any stories from back on that tour?
Well, the goal was to get out to Berkeley, to San Francisco, and try to play Gilman.
Okay.
Without having booked the show.
you were just so, planning on showing up and seeing what happened. Yeah,
we were fucked,
dude. I've been there before. You used to do those tours back in the day where you might have like three shows booked in a month, and you're just hoping you can find shows on the way.
That's our whole plan was. We just piled in a van and did that. But the first night we played in Rapid City, South Dakota, which at the time was this strange Midwestern punk rock mecca. Everybody went there and played there, and we ended up playing our first night. We played with Jawbreaker.
Wow.
And that was like, holy fuck, this is crazy. And we finished, and then Blake from Jawbreaker said, no, keep playing, you guys are great. So we kept playing, and that was like, wow, this is great. And then afterwards we go to this party, and I made out with this girl, and I was like, holy shit, this is crazy.
America.
is it gonna be like this every night?
Yeah, of course not, right?
And then it never was again.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a false sense of what's going to happen. I think that's hilarious. That was the first night of the tour. And then,
yeah, it was crazy.
That's awesome. And so back then, was it all like you guys were in a van, or were you guys like, I know back in my first tour, we were in like two cars.
We were in our friend's van on that first tour. Yeah. Our very first, like you say, on our very first trip out of Winnipeg, which was just a trip to the neighboring province. We took two cars. Yeah, it was the same thing.
So when you guys came across on that first tour to the States, was there any problems at the border or anything? I mean, like, did they know what you guys were doing? Because I know when I was younger, my first time I ever went to Canada, we weren't like a signed band or anything. And we were stuck at the border for like 8 hours because they, well, are you're going to be working in our country? And I was like, well,
right,
we probably won't make any money.
Yeah, no, the '90s were kind of a magical time. All the pre 9/11 border crossings, like what we would do, we would never cross at the main border crossings. We would wait until about 8:45. Or try to arrive at the border at 8:45, but it would be one, like a rural border,
okay,
where it was just like some local farmer was the border guard.
Yeah.
And the border's supposed to close at 9. We'd show up 15 minutes early and he'd be like, oh, for Christ's sake, you guys, what are you, and you know, and he'd be like, okay, go ahead. He wouldn't even check the van.
That's awesome, man.
But, and then eventually we would get people in Minneapolis to, well, I can't remember the name of the record label, but they'd write us fake recording papers. So it looked like we were coming down to put money into US economy to record. And then we just stay there for 2 months.
That's awesome, man. So, I want to talk a little bit about this. You guys were together, you were doing all that stuff in 1992. It's, you know, it's folklore by this point. You played a show with NOFX. How did all that come about? Did Fat Mike talk to you guys right away? I mean, were you guys leery of signing to that label? Like, what was the feeling, like the general feeling around all that?
Like right after the show, he came up to us and wanted a tape, and I gave him a tape and he never paid me for it. And
of course, right?
Yeah. And I should charge him interest.
Oh, you should totally charge him interest at this point. Yeah.
30 years of interest.
Yeah.
And he started calling us, and I was like, yeah, it sounds good. I could record it on a 4-track up here. And he's like, no, I want to do a real record, and like in a real studio. And I just kept thinking, well, this is not going to happen.
Like, yeah.
It's just not going to happen. And eventually he's like, okay, you guys just get plane tickets down to LA and I'll record you at West Beach. I'll pay for it. And I thought, holy shit, that's where those Bad Religion records are.
Yeah.
Fuck. Is he serious? This guy fucking serious? And
because at that point, Fat Records wasn't really even known. I mean, like they'd only had a couple records out. So I mean, that's gotta be kind of a scary thing. Like, you know, NOFX, but he's wanting you to, you know, risk a lot by coming all the way to Los Angeles. I mean, were you guys a little bit freaked out?
I think so. I think, we were just so disorganized and not serious about the band, that it was hard to get it going. And, I don't know what we were thinking, but eventually we got down there and we were really there and really making a record.
Yeah.
And then it hit me like, holy shit, we should have practiced.
Yeah. Cause what was it like in the studio? Was that your first experience in like a real studio?
Yeah. We had been doing four track demos in like my mom's basement for a few years and just doing it whenever we felt like it, you know? So we would never finish a recording in a week.
Yeah.
We'd do it over the course of a few months, just like, whenever we're bored, we'll do it. So like it was very stressful, because there was no turning back.
Yeah.
You had like each guy literally had one day to do all 13 songs.
Wow.
So I had one day to do both guitars and all the vocals. And I just was like, these are not good. These are not good.
I know when I went to the studio for the first time, I know I was kind of cocky, like, oh, I'm a good guitarist. And then when you get in there and everything's under a microscope, it kind of makes you realize that you're not a fully formed musician. Did you have any like anxiety about going into the studio the next time?
No, we did not learn our lesson at all. Like with the next record, we showed up to San Francisco and started recording for like 2 weeks, and then we're like, oh, we don't have enough songs and these ones aren't finished, and we had to go home.
Really?
Yeah. That's how stupid we were.
So what was the you guys went home and wrote some more songs, or like, how did that all go?
Yeah, that's what happened. It's absolutely ridiculous to to remember it, but that's what happened.
Was the label kind of upset with that whole thing, that it took a little bit longer? There was that extra recording stuff going on?
I think they were in disbelief and maybe amused by it because we were paying for it, you know, like,
yeah,
it was coming out of our whatever royalties we would ever make off the record. So I don't think they really cared too much, especially because things were going so well for them at the time.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
With other bands and NoFX and stuff.
I mean, there was the glory days of those, you know, early to mid 90s for Epitaph and Fat. So
yeah,
it's crazy that you guys kind of were at the beginning of that. And then through those times as well, did it ever, like, when did it kind of occur to you that, wow, this is kind of something, you know, like, I don't want to use the term like we've made it, because there's so many bands that, you know, it seems to outsiders like they've made it, but they probably haven't. Was there a time or like a moment where it all just kind of made sense to you and it felt like it was really becoming something?
No, someone had asked me sort of the same question the other day, and I realized it wasn't until 2009.
Okay.
When we made supporting cast, that I was like, wow, this is cool. We have something pretty cool that could have some longevity.
Yeah. You've got to admit though, it's crazy that in 2009, that was your first thought, because I mean, this is what, your 33rd year as a band?
Yeah, probably.
It's crazy, man.
I think what had happened in 2009 was like, we were finally a four piece for the first time.
Yeah.
And the songs, sounded more like I had always hoped they would sound, you know. It took that long. It took 19, 20 years to get where we wanted to go.
What took you guys so long in maybe deciding to become a four piece? Because with the style of music, and just it lends itself to the two guitar attack, you know, with the different harmonies and whatnot going on. Was it a logistics thing, or did you just finally decide to do it?
I think we were just mostly concerned about chemistry.
Okay.
Like, cause me, Todd, and Jord are like, there's a real specific chemistry that keeps things rolling with us.
Yeah.
And we just didn't, I think we thought, we don't want to upset that. How is someone going to fit into this? And around 2006 or 7 or 8 or whatever, when Beav joined the band, you know, I had been hanging out with Beav for a few years, and I was like, this guy could roll with us. He's kind of the same.
He's a shredder too, man. I saw you guys live with him a few times, and he kills it, man.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he's sort of a kindred spirit. And then when Sulin came along, again, we were like, oh, how's this going to work? How are we going to mash his people? And it didn't take too long for us to be like, oh, yeah, Sulin's also a kindred spirit. So, yeah, we got real lucky.
So when, you know, I read that Beav left the band to pursue his teaching career. When that happened in 2015, what was the process for finding Sulin? I think I remember there being like a thing on Facebook or on somewhere on the internet, like, you know, send a video in if you want to be the new guitarist for Propaganda. And all my buddies were like trying to get me to do it. But I was very scared because I teach guitar for a living. You know, I'm pretty much a shredder. But when I watch you play, I get a little bit of cold feet, I got to say.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. I don't feel like I'm a shredder at all.
Well, I mean, it's the energy and just the way that, I mean, it's kind of weird to say, but the way you kind of attack your instrument, like I've seen you guys live many times, and it's just, I don't know. Everything is so tight and precise. And with you and Beav together, I'd seen that a few times and I just thought that it was so great. So when there was going to be an announcement for a new guitarist, I was like, man, you know, who is this going to be? And since then I've seen videos of you with Sulin, and it's, I mean, you guys aren't missing a beat. It's almost exactly the same.
Yeah. It was, when we first were facing having to find a guitar player, like we discussed, well, do we just pick up a buddy from here in town,
yeah,
you know, like do the easy thing, or do we make this kind of exciting? Like, do we try to find, you know, the next level? And that's kind of why we put the word out, which people were like, what are you guys doing? Like, that's not how you do it. You just find somebody internally. But that's not what we wanted to do. And then, I mean, finding Sulin was just like fucking winning the lottery, you know, like this really interesting person from a different place and yeah. different background. And it's fucking awesome.
Were there any other, like, you know, you don't have to name names or anything, but were there others that were potentially in the running there at the end before you guys went with Sulin?
Yeah. Yeah. There was lots of really good, like lots of people are technically amazing players.
But they might be assholes, right? When you get on tour.
Yeah, they could be, but I mean, we didn't even get that far with some people. It was just more like, it was hard to really put our finger on it. Like Sulin, just the very first kind of correspondence with her was like, it kind of stood out. Like not just because of the way she identifies in the world, but just the way she was kind of speaking about why she wanted to do it.
Okay.
It was more like, it was less about being the guitar player in this. I don't know. It was weird. It was just like, it kind of stood out like just the, some sort of earnestness but honesty and not trying to sell herself.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was weird. It just right away, I thought this person's kind of like us.
And I mean, yeah, you talk about kindred spirits, like, you know, with Propagandhi being, you know, the type of band with the, you know, you guys have political, you know, stuff in your lyrics and there's certain stances that you take on certain issues. You would probably have to find somebody that aligned themselves at least with your ideals, correct?
We didn't really have to cross that bridge with Sulin because she was like, she was on the same page anyways.
Yeah. Yeah.
With everything. Well, with, I mean, anything we've had to deal with, or we've talked about, so far. She didn't make a cut because of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was more, she sent this video of, her playing in the studio, playing Night Letters and some other song. And I was just like, fuck, she's like, I can't, she's nailing it.
Yeah.
And it was, and the other stuff was gravy, you know, it was like, oh, she's also vegan. Fucking A. We don't have to worry about that. She's,
yeah.
She's also not a dipshit. She's on the same team. So.
And she can sing harmony as well. That's one thing, man. I mean, cause I know Beav did that and like just hearing you guys with the backup vocals, like she kills it every time.
Right. And she can sing a little higher, than I can, which is great. So she can handle some of the higher parts.
Oh yeah.
So
when you, you know, did you and Beav have definite like different parts that you played in the songs, or like when she came in, was there a set thing she was learning, or do you guys kind of go back and forth? And how, I mean, I know that the song she wasn't a part of course, there was the part you played and the part he played, but is there ever, do you guys ever kind of retool anything for live?
If we do, it's probably pretty minor, just because since Sulin lives in New York, she shows up like 5 days before we go on tour.
Yeah.
So we don't have tons of time to, it's mostly like nailing the song as it is. There's not a lot of time to investigate other ways of doing the songs. But she's so quick with, effects and adding depth and dimension that it's kind of like Beav. Like Beav was good at that too. He was able to hear what I was playing and then add something that's adds kind of a layer instead of just like an alternate part, add some atmosphere to it. So she's really good at that too. So that's very helpful.
So when you're playing these leads, I mean, I know we talked about it and you, you said that you don't really know theory. Do you just know where to start and then take it from there? Like, what is your thought process when you're playing leads? Like, I know like the beginning of Coach's Corner and a couple other songs, they're pretty chromatic and they just go so fast. Even the notes that maybe don't fit, they sound really cool because they're the phrasing is so quick. But like, what is your process for when you're actually doing some sort of like lead part?
Well, for Coach's Corner, it was like, I was trying to channel a little bit of Dr. No from Bad Brains.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, like if you, the way the Eye Against Eye record starts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he's more in key than I am in Coach's Corner, but it's that in the '80s, there was like kind of this explosive fucking, it didn't have to be like a proper scale. when people were doing solos in some hardcore bands, a few metal bands, like mentioning Creator again, like he fucking was never playing in key. He was just ripping up and down. And I kind of wanted to evoke a bit of that. And I remember saying that when we were recording The Blasting Room, like I was like, I want this solo to sound like Dr. No from Bad Brains. And Bill was like, you're no Dr. No. And then pressed record and off I went. So,
well, it's great, man. I can see what you're saying. I mean, I talk about it with my students all the time because some of my students are, they want to learn theory and some of them just want to learn songs. And I have this one student that's really into Pantera. And we were learning some Pantera stuff. And what I realized as never dissecting it when I was young is that, like, the song Walk by Pantera, all 12 notes are in that song. It's really strange. Like, they put them in certain places where, in context, because of what the bass is playing, you know, what the guitar is playing, it all works together. But it's really, you'd be hard pressed to find out exactly what key that song is because there's so much going on in that song, you know?
Oh, weird.
I don't know if you're a Pantera fan. I was when I was young. I don't listen too much anymore, but
I was not a Pantera fan.
Well, let's talk about things that you were a fan of. You've mentioned Venom and different bands like that. Now, one of my favorite things that you guys have done, and it's kind of a little joke in one of the songs, is when you said, by the way, I stole this riff, and you play the little Metallica riff. Were you a fan of Metallica? Like, did that influence you at all?
Oh, I was a huge Metallica fan. Yeah. I guess like Venom, I loved Venom. They were my favorite band, but I think the bands that guitar wise were more important were probably Metallica, early Metallica, Dave Mustaine.
Oh yeah.
Early stuff. And that first Exodus LP. Like I couldn't play quite like any of those guys, but I was really trying to get there.
Yeah.
You know, ballpark wise, rhythm guitar. I really love the way Gary Holt plays on that first Exodus record. It's just crushing.
So when you guys put out the first few records, what I've noticed, and I'm sure you've probably talked about this at length, but as you know, sequentially as the records came out, the musicianship got so much tighter and so much more of the metal influence came out. Do you attribute that to just, you know, touring and getting better on your instrument?
Maybe not to touring, more to just being at home and you know, trying to catch up with yourself. Just spending more time in the practice space, really, for us. Like, we're not like a road warrior kind of band, really. And most of the time, I mean, the most fun I have in the band is in the practice space. And it's always been that way. And we spent most of our time there instead of on the road. So that's, we just got better just by being in the practice space.
I know that you guys recently put out a tab book. Was that a pretty long and drawn out process?
Sometimes it is. Yeah. Cause we have these guys, they're really good. It's the Sheet Happens Publishing out in Toronto.
They have something to do with Protest the Hero, correct? Cause I know they put some stuff out as well.
Yeah, it's actually Luke and Tim from Protest the Hero that do this company. And they have transcribers. It's like guys they go to, they give them the record and say, okay, transcribe this. And they do it. And it's unbelievably close for people who don't, you know, for transcribers who don't even know the band.
Yeah.
But, and we could just let them, we could not proofread them and let it go out there and it'd be close enough. But Todd and I always like to go through the transcriptions and make sure they're as close to accurate as possible to what we're playing. And there's always, it's long and drawn out because we have to go through it, you know, line by line and like, okay, well, this note's not quite right. This note's not quite right. I don't know why we do that, but well, I guess, cause when I grew up, you get tabs for stuff and you'd be like, there's no way this is not how you play Jump.
Well, yeah, I remember getting a Ride the Lightning tab book when I was probably 14 and I would try to play the stuff and like a lot of it was right, but there was a lot of it that was not right. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, Kirk Hammett and James didn't like sign off on those tabs.
No, it was just their management company just like ramming these deals through, I'm sure.
I think it's such a cool idea for you guys to do that because, you know, as a guitar instructor, I kind of teach two different ways. We have the set, you know, way where you go through the theory and you learn all your scales. And then I've got other kids that, you know, their parents are paying me money and maybe they don't want to play on a cruise ship. Maybe they don't want to go teach in college. So we just do songs and have fun and learn through that. And I use a lot of internet tabs, and 9 times out of 10, they are horribly wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've even looked at Propagandhi tabs, and a lot of them, they're not even semi close to what you guys are playing.
Yeah. It's crazy. I find that very frustrating. I've even joined a couple of those tab companies online. Like, you know, when I want to look up a Peter Gabriel Salisbury Hill tab or something.
Yeah.
And then I'll even pay for a subscription. And then I'm like trying to play this alleged authorized transcription. It's like, this is not what the guy's playing.
Yeah, totally. Like,
come on.
So when you're, you know, we've talked a little bit about songwriting, and when you're doing this, I mean, some people, they say it's like either way, both ways. When you're doing this, does the music come first, or is it lyrics first? Or do you like have, you know, a quote unquote poem written or whatever, and then you try to put that and make the phrasing fit? Like, what comes first for you guys?
Yeah, it's different every time. I think things happen in parallel. Like we're writing ideas down, in a book, you know, and then at the same time in the practice space, we're trying some riffs out, and these things are just happening in parallel until they kind of eventually meet somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, you never know when or why they meet. But when they do, then you gotta, you know, strike while the iron's hot and try to flesh it out. But there's always, I guess, I mean, the music's, for me, making riffs happens more often. Like I'm always, you know, on this phone here, I have this little voice memo recorder, and I'm always recording little snippets from an acoustic guitar or electric guitar on it, but I'm not always writing down lyrics or ideas. Yeah. It's kind of more like when we consciously decide we should make a record soon, and I start writing the ideas down then, you know?
Well, I know that every time that I've seen you play, a lot of the times you've played an ESP, I think it's a Eclipse EC1000. And then I've also seen you play in the SG. I know that you just had a new signature guitar come out. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, it's killer. Yeah, it's just,
it looks killer, man. I saw it online. It looks awesome.
Yeah, it's this local guy, Al Beardsell. He's kind of he's a genius. He's a mad genius, a mad scientist, and a really cool guy. And he makes really high-end, mostly acoustic guitars, but a few solid bodies. And I just ran the idea by him one day of making an SG, and he was like, fuck, I would try that. And when Sulin first came up here to try out for the band, she brought this like 73 SG custom that had 3 pickups in it. And I was like, oh, I mean, that thing doesn't stay in tune, but fuck, does it look good?
Yeah.
And so I kind of kept that in mind. And then Al and I worked out like a body shape that wasn't quite an SG, but wasn't quite, what's that fucking ESP makes like an SG style.
Oh, I can't remember the name of it. It looks kind of like
a Viper.
Viper, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it wasn't quite, it didn't look as, you know, bargain bin as the Viper, but which is kind of a cool guitar on its own. But yeah, the finished product is just killer.
So are they going to like be for sale to the public, or is it just for you?
Oh, I think you could ask them to make you one, but,
So it's all custom, like total custom, right?
Oh yeah. Like, yeah. He makes the pick. He makes everything.
That's
everything.
Awesome. That's crazy, yeah. Man. So does it have an Evertune system on it? Cause I saw online that you guys seem to use the Evertune system quite a bit.
Yeah. That was actually kind of the, like he built it around the Evertune, because most of my, like I have other SGs and each one of them has an Evertune, but an SG body is kind of too thin.
Yeah.
For the Evertune bridge. So it's always sticking out the back a bit. Doesn't bother me, but people hate the look of it.
Yeah.
So he built this SG, intentionally to accommodate the entirety of the Evertune bridge. So it wouldn't be sticking out the back.
Wow.
So yeah, it's cool.
Did you just recently get it? Did you have it on your last tour of Australia?
That's the only tour I had it on so far.
So you've played it on tour. Does it like, you seem like you love it. Like, how does it stand up to what you've used in the past?
It's like, I have this other SG. It's like a 97. It's the Jesus SG. It has like a picture of a pick guard with Jesus on it. That's my number one. It's like this magical SG. I've never heard another SG like it.
Yeah. I heard you talking on some interview. You got it from some guy off Craigslist or something. You met him at a gas station.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was the best classified ad I'd ever answered.
That's awesome.
And this one is maybe not sonically the closest. Well, it's different. Like every SG is kind of different. But this one is different in its own totally awesome way.
Okay.
Than that one. I'd say it's almost on par. Actually, it plays smoother than my Jesus SG. Like, it feels better on my left hand. But I mean, yes, the Jesus SG is still its own thing.
So when I saw you play, I mean, just on videos and whatnot as well, but last time I saw you guys play was 2015 at the Vinyl in Pensacola, Florida, when Beeve was still in the band. And at that show, you were playing the LTD. What are your thoughts on those guitars? Was that something that you really enjoyed playing? Because I have a couple of LTDs. I really like them. Is that something you had out of necessity, or did you enjoy playing those guitars?
That was my gateway into Evertune.
Okay.
I thought, I didn't want to cut up my guitars at the time to put in the Evertune bridge because I didn't know if it was going to be good for me or not. So I bought one of those LTDs with the Evertune in it, and I was sold on the Evertune very quickly, and I really liked the guitar itself. It just the pickups that kind of worked in that were those EMGs.
Yeah, I have like the 81 and the 85 in mine.
I think that's what was in mine too. But it just was not quite as, it was kind of congested sounding compared to my other guitars. So I actually sold that one to finance putting an Evertune in one of my other SGs. So.
What you said that guy made the pickups for this guitar as well?
Yeah.
So what are they comparable to? Can you give me like a comparison?
Well, the first one he made for me was, I said, I want a really high output pickup for this. And he said, oh yeah, yeah, I'll make you one. So, but it was his idea of high gain.
it was not your idea of high gain, right?
Yeah. And I just like, you know, I need it more high gain. I need it to sound like this. Similar to this this bare knuckle nail bomb.
Yeah.
And he did a bunch of measurements on the bare knuckle I have in my other SG, and he made a pickup based on that. And it just immediately was like, fuck yeah, that's a good pickup.
That's awesome, man. Well, I've gotta say that, you know, the tones on the last record, which we can, you know, go into talking about Victory Lap, they're brutal, man. Like how long do you guys take trying to find those tones in the studio? Is it a plug and play, or do you kind of, you know, like slave over it for a while?
It's kind of plug and play.
Okay.
There's not too much fooling around. Like it, you know, the guitar sounds like it sounds, and then the engineer puts up a mic to make sure it sounds like that in the control room.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like I don't like to tweak too much. And I, especially on the last record, I kind of, even like performance wise, I didn't want it to be super precise. Like, I want it to sound a little bit ragged. Even to the point where, you know, I could have played it better, but sometimes I don't want it to be played better because I want it to have an authentic feel.
Yeah.
Cause a lot of records, I think these days there's so much opportunity to make things so precise that it kind of kills the humanity of the, of the record.
Like, I mean, you can use Pro Tools, but you don't have to like Pro Tools the human element out of it. Right.
Yeah. Or even prior to like using Pro Tools to adjust things, some people will just do endless takes until they finally nail that thing.
Yeah.
And I just think, back in the 80s, the records I grew up on, you just didn't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
And I really like the sounds of those records because each one sounds like its own thing. And part of that is like even small flaws in the playing. Like one example I always think of is Double Kick in the 2000s on records compared to Double Kick in the 80s. Like if you listen to in a song like Fight Fire with Fire, and you hear that double kick part in the middle, or even on Slayer's Rain and Blood, like the double kick parts aren't perfect.
Yeah, they're not. It's not supposed to be perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's a real person trying desperately to play this part. And that's kind of what conveys a sense of like, of urgency to the part. And guitar wise, I kind of like to have a bit of that too. Like,
yeah.
Like this feeling like I'm playing over my head and couldn't quite get there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I kind of like that vibe.
I like that vibe as well, man. What was the last record you guys made to tape?
Like completely to tape?
Yeah, like to, you know, 24 track, 2-inch. Like completely to tape. I mean, I guess the last record that you used the majority was tape. I know some people do like vocals on, you know, digitally or whatever.
Yeah, well, we used 2-inch tape all the way up to 2005 Potemkin City Limits.
Okay.
But then we did the guitars and vocals in Pro Tools, but we did all the drums on tape. The last full tape record was Less Talk More Rock.
Okay. I think that's kind of cool because that warmness of the tape for the drum tones is probably really good.
Yeah. And on the last record on Victory Lap, we didn't do it to tape, but one of the guys at the studio we recorded at had a refrigerator sized rack of Neve 1073 preamps.
Wow.
And they convey like original ones, yeah. not like imitation ones. And they kind of contribute a similar tape-ish sound to drums, you know, kind of shaving off the transients a bit and filling in the blanks on the low end. And I just love that sound. I think the sound of the drums on Victory, obviously Jason Livermore's mixing helped.
Oh, but, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
But the way they were put to the hard disk through these Neve 1073 preamps kind of made them a little more 1980s than 2000s. So that was great.
So you guys recently did that. Is it just a remaster or is it a remix of Failed States?
It's a remaster, but it was remastered from the stems.
Oh, okay.
So the mastering engineer, Jason Livermore, at the Blasting Room had a lot more latitude for how he was treating each element of the record. Like he could compress the stems at different ratios and stuff like that. And it almost is like a remix because it just
when I listened to it, I heard parts that I never knew were there, like different layers and stuff.
Yeah. It's like a cloud was lifted off the whole thing.
Yeah. It sounds great. I mean, I love the production on every record you guys have ever put out. I love even the, you know, the first few records where maybe it's a little bit different, but it's this time stamp, you know what I mean? Like, and since, you know, Potemkin City Limits, it's been like just this amazing wall of noise, but it's so precise. And then when I heard that remaster, I mean, it just brought it to a whole new level.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I was really happy with it because it stuff jumped out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was what was supposed to happen in the first place, but the first mastering job was really uninspired.
So who came up with the idea to do that?
I guess me and Jason Livermore, like when I was down there, I think when we were mixing Victory Lap, we were just shooting the shit like we usually do. And it came up like, what could you do to Failed States if I could get you the stems? And he was like, yeah, I could fucking make that sound better. And I was like, okay, let's do that. And then I asked the record label, you guys interested? And they said, fuck yeah, let's do it.
That's awesome, man. Well, yeah. Speaking of record label, you guys are, you know, your last record Victory Lap did come out on Epitaph. A couple of the other ones came out on Epitaph. How is it working with Epitaph?
It's great. They've been great to us so far. You know, especially since, you know, we're not one of the bands that is paying their bills, you know.
Yeah.
Like we're, I'm sure it's some young, goofy band with swoopy hair that's making all the money for them. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure what's going on, but
yeah.
But everybody we've dealt with there is like so has been so accommodating. It's not that different than than the vibe that at Fat Records,
yeah,
which was also very, you know, everybody was super nice and super chill and helpful.
I have some listener questions, if you wouldn't mind answering those. We're getting down to the end here. I don't want to take up a lot more of your time, but I had some people write in and ask some questions, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well, Glenn from Melbourne, Australia, he wants to know if there was a specific moment that influenced you to get into punk or to, you know, change your thoughts about music and kind of how the world worked.
Yeah, it was that first MDC record.
Okay.
Prior to which I would have classified myself as a slightly right-wing nationalist. And then the MDC record came along and just shattered my worldview.
Yeah.
Or it helped shatter my worldview.
I think it's cool that a lot of people probably have that same sentiment, but for a record that you guys put out.
Oh, maybe I would hope that would be the case, because that's, I mean, for me, that was the turning point in my life. And I guess that's what we've hoped we would try to do for,
I mean, you guys opened my eyes somebody else. When I was 14 or 15 years old up to stuff that I didn't think about before. I mean, everything from, you know, animal rights to, you know, pro-feminism to just so many things that maybe your average Midwestern teenager's not going to think about. You opened my eyes to that. So there's got to be thousands of people around the world that what you're saying about MDC is the same for them, for Propagandhi.
Yeah, I sure hope so. That'd be like paying it forward. So
yeah
that the MDC record, it's just, I mean, that record also stands the test of time. It's so fucking outrageously good,
yeah,
even by today's standards. So exciting.
Okay, so I've got Patrick from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and this is a question that I had as well. The song Laughing Stock, why was it considered a B-side? Why didn't it make the record?
I don't even know now.
It's a good song, man. It's so good.
I think, I don't know what the fuck we were thinking. I think towards the end of making Victory Lap, we were just getting anxious and confused, and time was tight, and we're trying to figure out sequencing, and how long should the record be. And, I mean, Laughing Stock was supposed to be on Failed States. Like, we had finished it for that, a different version of it. And then redid it for this record. And the second time around, maybe we thought, we had lost some of the momentum with it. I don't know what the fuck we were thinking, but I kind of wish it had been on the record. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was a huge fan of the record. I mean, all the records, of course, but when I saw the post of that song on Facebook and I listened to it and I'm like, how did this not make the fucking record, man? This song is great.
Yeah, I regret that. Damn it.
Well, hey, at least it's out there, right? It's out there now for people.
Yeah.
Okay, one more listener question. I've got Sam from Cincinnati, Ohio. He wants to know, what is the biggest misconception of the band for maybe people that you meet on tour or just people in general?
Huh. The biggest misconception about us?
Yeah.
That we're American, maybe?
I can see that, yeah.
I think lots of people think we're from California.
I mean, I guess being tied to Fat Records and, you know, the political stuff in the songs. I mean, that song, Adventures in Zucosis, where it's got like the Trump like sample. I mean, for one thing, that's an amazing song, but I can see how somebody that's maybe a casual listener might not exactly know where you guys are from.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. 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 And with that first record, obviously it seemed like a California skate punk band.
Yeah.
You know, so we dug our own grave there. So,
well, I know that, you know, over interviews and things that I've seen that, and, you know, the Fat Wreck documentary and everything, I know that you guys kind of felt kind of like a fish out of water with some of those bands, but, you guys are always my favorite on the label. I didn't get into all the frat boy stuff, you know?
Oh, nice. Thanks.
you got it, man. You changed my outlook. I was a young kid, didn't really know what I was getting into. And then I heard you guys, it's like, oh, okay, this is how you're supposed to be. Or at least this is an idea. This is an idea. I'm not seeing you guys brainwash me or anything.
Yeah. Don't blame us.
No, I'm not going to blame you guys. Okay. Well, we've come to the end of the conversation, but I have a question I've been asking people lately. I do a top five list on the podcast, and, I'm interested in asking you this because I know you and I both have a love for Metallica. And for some reason, Metallica comes up a lot on this podcast. It's not about Metallica, but they're one of my favorite bands. They got me to learn how to play guitar at the beginning. So their first five records, I would like you to, off the top of your head, from five to one, one being your favorite, list them.
Of Metallica records?
Yes, sir.
Five of them?
Yeah, the first five records.
Well, can I include the Creeping Death EP?
I mean, yeah, or you could just use, you know, I mean, yeah, if you just, okay, just your top five Metallica releases. How's that? You can do EPs, you can do whatever you want.
Okay. But I have to go from five down instead of one.
Well, you can do it the other one way, five. Whatever. Usually one is your favorite, but if you want five to be your favorite, that's fine.
No. One is my favorite and it's Ride Lightning.
Okay. Okay.
Two would be Kill 'Em All.
Awesome.
Three would be Master of Puppets.
Okay.
Four would be The Garage Days Revisited.
Revisited or re-revisited?
Revisited. Like
the one with Blitzkrieg and Am I Evil?
No, sorry. That would be my fifth.
Okay.
And then the fourth would be the one where Jason Newsted, his first...
With like Crash Course and Brain Surgery and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, it was called the 599 EP at the time or something like that.
Yeah, what they did was Garage Days Revisited was when they put those two songs on Kill 'Em All, and then Revisited was his first release, the 599 EP. Yeah.
Yeah. So those would be that'd be my five.
Cool. Well, it's really nice to know that now. I wanted to say, like, at one point you were on Facebook and we were friends on Facebook, and I always loved it because you'd post like really cool vinyl and like, I mean, what made you decide to get off Facebook?
Facebook was making me dislike people that I otherwise liked.
Dude, it does that to me every day. If I didn't have the podcast, I would probably get off of Facebook, honestly.
Yeah. I find that with all social media, actually. I find it's just people act differently and you learn stuff about them that you don't learn about them in the course of just hanging out in real life. So I think I'm just better off not interacting online with many people.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, man. I've had a blast speaking with you. I'm glad that we could figure it out. And this kind of happened through social media, so we'll give it one little gold star for that. But the one thing that I want to know, what does the future of the band look like? I know you guys are going to Europe at the end of the month.
Yeah, there's just, it looks like things are going to get busy for summer and fall, relatively busy for us. And then I don't know what's happening after that. It's all a mystery. Life is a mystery.
Any talks of a new record anytime soon? I know that Victory Lap came out a couple years ago.
Yeah, we usually don't talk about a new record for 3 years after the last one.
Okay.
I don't know why we do that.
It's Are there so any like riffs kicking around in your memo on your phone?
Oh, yeah. There's riffs all over the place.
Oh, that's cool. But, man.
I don't know what to do with them.
Well, you guys have been around for 33 years. In a perfect world, it would be 33 more years. And I wish you guys, I wish you guys all the good fortune. And I'm so glad you came on the show. This was a bucket list for me. I know I'm being fanboy, but it was great talking to you, and getting to nerd out about gear and stuff was great. Cause not all my guests play guitar. So.
Oh yeah. Nice. Well, I really appreciate you having me on here, Chris.
Yeah, no problem. Really cool. Can you give out the socials for the band? I know we just downplayed social media, but I'd like my listeners to check it out.
How would I do that?
Is it at Propagandi on Instagram?
What is that? Todd does that.
I tell you what, I'll just put him in the show notes. I'll check it out. You don't have to say another word, man.
Okay. I have a Patreon page.
Okay. Yeah, totally.
It's patreon.com/JesusHChris, I think.
And you guys are doing like podcasts and stuff over there as well, right?
Yeah, I just do it by myself.
Okay.
I don't bother the other guys with that. But if people are interested in that, they can check that out.
Cool. Well, Chris, I just want to say thank you so much. And when you guys do have a new record come out, please come back and talk to us on the podcast.
For sure, man.
Awesome. Well, have a great evening. And I will talk to you soon, my friend.
Right on, Chris. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
So there it was, my conversation with Mr. Chris Hanna from Propagandi. I had such a great time talking to Chris, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. Hopefully we'll have him back in the future for a part two. We didn't even scratch the surface. I mean, there's so much other cool stuff with Propagandi. I've loved them since I was in high school. And it was wonderful getting to have him on the show. If you would go back and tell like 15, 16 year old Chris that, you know, you're going to be talking on the phone for over an hour with Chris Hanna from Propagandhi. I would not have believed you. And, but now we have it here for posterity. It is immortalized on the internet. So thank you guys so much for checking this out. If you're new and you just came here for Propagandhi, we have so many other episodes with great bands that you will love. Go back through the archives. You can go to TOTOTpodcast.com and check out all that. We're available on all of the podcast apps and platforms and whatever. So I'm going to get out of here. Make sure to check out all of my sponsors, The Guts, Heathen and Heretic, Merge 4, Permanence Tattoo Gallery, Rockabilia.com, everything. We couldn't do it without our amazing sponsors. If you guys want to help us out, go to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast and get involved. And that's it. If you want to really help and you don't want to like give us money, you can just go to iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify or wherever you listen to this show and leave an awesome review, preferably 5 stars. It really helps people and like the whole algorithm and everything so people can find the show. So if you enjoy the show, tell a friend, leave a review, you know, hit us up on Instagram, give us ideas for guests, whatever. It's going to be awesome. So I have a couple episodes down, you know, coming in down the pipeline that are ready to go. I'm not sure which one I'm going to put out next week. It's going to be a surprise. So keep an ear to the ground and you'll find out who's going to be on the show. But it's going to be a great episode because all the episodes coming up are amazing. I mean, that's me saying it, but you can trust me because you guys listen all the time. You know that I don't lie. So I will see you guys next week with an amazing episode. Like I said, I'm going to surprise you with who it is. But that's it for this one, man. It's a wrap. I always play music. It was hard for me to pick a song, so I just kind of, I was hanging out with my son today, and I put Propagandhi on Spotify and just hit, you know, shuffle. And I heard this one. I hadn't heard it for a long, really long time, and I love it. I remember hearing it at the beginning. And the thing that's really cool with this is it's called Potemkin City Limits, but it wasn't on the album Potemkin City Limits. It was actually on 2009 Supporting Cast. So I'm going to play Potemkin City Limits by Propagandhi. I love you all. Thank you for checking out this podcast. Please come back next week, and I will see you then. Chris, out. Francis didn't give a fuck about the Rolex. Overproduction reduced demand. Never gave much stock to the spirit contracts. In a short life, it only ever known. Panic, fear, pain, darkness, pandemonium. In this hell that was his home, man. Fourth quarter earning expectations. The panic grew as the humans stopped among them. When the screaming began, Francis shut his eyes and felt the hand of the humanity brush over him. But for the killers battered for a moment, a blinding ray of light spread across the floor. In a crimson pool he saw his own reflection as he bolted for the door. Not just some fractured fairy tale, although I wish that that were true. This is a fable far too real, we somehow still cling to. The chasms between cognition and belief. Any other plausible denial that might offer some relief from the dissonance.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.